Hi, I'm Arish Shah, host of the Nothing Ventured podcast. As a CFO that has operated in the startup and scale-up ecosystem for the last decade, and as a founder myself, I found it absolutely essential to learn from those that have come before me. So this podcast is an exploration of the people, the characters, the stories, and the narratives that make the venture ecosystem go round. From emerging fund managers to established VCs, from angel investors to founders, I chat to people that make the tech ecosystem thrive. Please remember to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast because it really helps with our discoverability. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the pod. On today's podcast, I was super excited to have with me in the studio Maya Mufarek. Maya is founder and full stack CMO at Marketing Cube, where she partners with startup and scale up founders and CEOs to help define and implement their growth path. She is an angel investor with Ventures Together, an advisor and startup coach at Antler, and has had an incredible career, including time at Google, NotOnTheHighStreet.com, American Express, and Pharmacy to You, where she helped propel the business to reaching an acquisition rate equivalent to opening a brick and mortar pharmacy every 2.5 days. On today's episode, we talked about Ventures Together, the rule of 40, locksmith moments in startups, and fitting a giraffe into a brand. Let's get straight into it. Maya, it's great to have you in the studio with me today. For our listeners, if you want to listen to some of Maya's background and experience, do check out the primer. But in the meantime, as I say, wonderful to have you in the studio with me. I'd love to kind of dive in and get a bit more detail around some of the experiences you've had.
Excited to be here.
Excellent. So you've been part of the scaling journey of Pharmacy to You after its merger with Chemist Direct. Can you share some of the key lessons from those experiences, and what unique challenges do you think D2C ventures face today in today's environment where digital acquisition has become so saturated? Mm-hmm. And how should they start thinking about scaling today when things have changed quite dramatically?
I mean, the core of the issue here is balancing profitability and growth, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's really the core of the issue. And, you know, assuming that, you know, product market fit has been found, right? So there's also a bit of that. The rule of 40 that is often used in SaaS businesses, I think, still very much applies to D2C. And for those not familiar, is really adding your growth rate and your profit margin, and it should be above 40. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how you balance both profitability and growth. So those are like some of the things that I'm, you know, discussing with some of the D2C businesses that I engage with these days. At Pharmacy to You, a low margin business, we knew that, you know, profitability at scale meant that we needed to acquire the right type of customers. That,
long-term,
you know,
users.
Yeah. Well, long-term users, but also that the actual basket will be profitable at, you know, quickly, if not from the get-go, right? And so with that, while, you know, we're an NHS licensed business, we would serve anyone who would want to sign up with us. My proactive acquisition activities were targeted at 40 plus patients, mm-hmm. because they typically have more than one product in their basket or medication in their basket, and therefore they're profitable.
So we tend to be less healthy as well. Is that the
yes
point?
Well, you know, there's some, you know, there's some scary, you know, I've got to learn about the health in the UK through that experience. Sure. And actually, if you're on repeat meds after your 40s, you're probably going to be on them for the rest of your life.
Good to know.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, stay healthy, people. So that, you know, kind of then meant that the vast majority of my cohorts were profitable from the get-go, etc. And so that's, you know, that's kind of what at Pharmacy to You we focused on. So whatever version of that means for you, really be sure to start with that. And I think even in that online repeat prescription industry, some businesses very quickly had to be bought off because they would have never been profitable based on their cohorts on their own. And so that's really what I think really propelled Pharmacy to You, and, you know, a lot of credit to our CFO and CEO at the time to installing that. The other consideration for today on those businesses is that at the core of it, you need to truly understand your customers. We touched on that a bit on the primer. You know, really understanding where the need is the strongest, what cohort will be the most profitable for you, and really doubling down on them. And then if the pain is the strongest with them, then that's where you can also build advocacy on that group and make sure that they will help amplify your message over time. So that's kind of another one. That then often leads for businesses to really start building communities, but real communities, not like those fake communities that you sell to, real communities where you add value, where there's a real value exchange within the group, right? It's not a one-way communication.
It's
peer-to-peer, where obviously the brand curates, provides experts, etc., and can create some of the conversation as well, provoke some of the conversations. But that then becomes, again, your megaphone, if you like. You know, some businesses that did really well, we touched on We Are Jude, which is a femtech I'm invested in and advise. Honestly, she had no product in market yet that she already had a community of women of that specific age, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that becomes really important. Really, your growth, I think what we're saying really is your growth flywheel can't be focused on your, can't be kind of dependent on your paid activity.
Yeah.
It can amplify it, but it can't be the single source of it. And so really what it means is that you have to start building your brand, your messaging, really that whole, you know, advocacy system from the early days. Now, you know, early stage startups are like, oh, I don't have brand market, you know, brand budgets, like I can't focus on that, etc. And that's where there's a lot of confusion about what brand marketing really means. It's not Nike type of ads. It means, you know, you look credible, you sound credible, you really understand your audience, you know, your one-page pitch on your homepage makes sense, right? Mm. And you can't afford not to have that.
Well, it can be as simple as, I mean, for me as an example, this podcast is part of my brand, my personal
that's
brand
right.
building, right?
That's right.
And not just personal, but for the business. And that's why
that's right.
we have the sort of guests that we have on. Yeah. And I just want to pause for a second because, you know, you talked a couple of times about cohorts and it's... Yeah. Cohorts always, you know, drive me into a bit of PTSD because as a CFO, we're always being asked to kind of do a cohort analysis, which often is being thought about in terms of time that a cohort has come on board, as in period that the cohort has started engaging with the business, you know, and what you tend to see is consumers that came on board in January that outperformed those that come in February, you'll see that pattern repeating itself sort of every year. But it's sort of, I've always wondered about correlation, causation. But how do you think about cohorts? Are you thinking about them more in terms of, okay, segmenting them in terms of age groups or in terms of personality types or in terms of kind of their purchasing preferences? How do you think about cohorts?
So if I go back to my CFO cohort conversations, usually it has to do with retention, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like basically it's per channel, per month, per etc.
Yeah.
You know, who's being retained. That's a retention cohorts is the starting point. When I and that is still very important as part of your full funnel kind of growth journey. And you know, I'm very much like I geekily call myself a full stack CMO because really you have to look at the whole thing. And I believe that great CMOs have to be targeted at marketing contribution level of your P&L, not acquisition and not whatever, you know, activation. You have to look at the whole thing. But when if you're looking at the whole thing, what you really want to know is that not only what channel is converting or retaining or etc., you also want to look at those, you know, signals, and that could be demographics, that could be, you know, for pharmacy to you, we would look at the whole spectrum of, is that diabetes patient? Is it, you know, heart condition patient? Is it like, you know, all of that? I mean, to some point I was looking at my cohorts because, you know, we're talking quite a few years ago as well. You know, there was still a kind of a propensity of the older population, I think way less now, of like signing up on a piece of paper. I mean, I would look at like, you know, if I do my DMs, if I'm not targeting a 60 or 70 year old, should I still include a piece of paper? Because it costs me money, right? And so you would look at your cohorts even in that way and saying, okay, I'm only gonna put the sign up piece of paper for the cohort over that specific age and looking at that. So they can be used in so many different ways. So yeah, I definitely would invite people to like, you know, look beyond just the retention cohort aspect that it's usually used in.
So essentially
that's really helpful.
Yeah, so essentially get as granular as you can on who that customer is.
Yeah.
Because that in theory, if you can figure out that, okay, well it turns out that my biggest evangelists are 37-year-old mothers of one child who live in, argument's sake, southeast of England rather, then you know that that's where you should actually spend your time and effort and energy looking for more
solo customers. Want to replicate those cohort, yeah, obviously in other places possibly and things like that. You know, I always go back to, at the end of the day, it's what your yeah, client is hiring your product to do. So I think there's definitely this much more general piece. But then when you want to find those, like, you know, very targeted growth opportunities, and so for us at Pharmacy2U, it was a lot around, should I be signing a partnership with the heart association, right, patient association, or the diabetes, and what do they want and what version of it, etc. So that's where I'll go really nitty gritty. You know, some people refer to it as kind of the locksmith moment in your activities, which is a very, you know, what is the moment they feel the pain and so they're ready to make a change, right? And so at Pharmacy2U, that moment was actually at the GP surgery. They already spent a whole bunch of time on the phone trying to get an appointment. Can't intervene at that point as a marketer. But then they're sitting in the GP surgery waiting for an appointment that they think is useless because they just want their prescription. And really, if they could avoid talking to the doctor, they would, because really it's just a repeat. It's not their normal, like, I need to recheck some, you know, blood test or whatever to confirm everything is still okay. And so we started buying, interestingly enough, I didn't know at the time, but there's media to be bought on the walls of GP surgeries because they're trying to make ends meet too. And so we started basically buying it all. And we wanted to make sure we were there because that was the moment where they're feeling frustrated and they didn't really know there was a different way, but then that this different way was, you know, facing them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess today it's so difficult to get into a GP surgery. I wonder whether that yeah, channel would work as well. Yeah. And like, in terms of, because I've often said, it was interesting you were talking about retention. I am on record as saying it's easier to keep existing customers than acquire new ones. And I think today, especially, I stand by that. Mm. And again, maybe it's part of my kind of finance brain that says that, you know, you are better off retaining a customer that has shown a propensity to buy. If you can upsell, cross-sell, if you really kind of delight them, show them that they're valued, then they'll come again and again. Whereas acquiring a new customer, you know, and many businesses do that through discounting or, offers or whatever it might be, and they churn sort of immediately. And so I've always sort of said, if you have a choice between acquisition and retention, retention is always the more powerful one. But especially for VC-backed businesses where showing that growth curve is essential, you know, often I have seen in the past businesses that will kind of give up on that retention aspect, they'll focus on growth at the cost of retention. How do you sort of think about that?
So even for early stage businesses, so first of all, there's obviously the product market fit moment. And the product market fit moment is not about scaling your channels, it's about finding that product market fit. So it's really working with small group of customers that you acquire, you know, to polish your messaging, your product, your proposition in general. So to some extent, it's really about retention, because really how you're going to meet product market fit is seeing that, you know, people that you acquire are now staying with you. So I think it actually starts with retention to prove even that your business has legs. After that, once maybe you already have a bit of money to start scaling, etc., I always say, well, yes, sure, start testing some channels. You have a bit more free cash to, like, you know, go a bit bigger on things. But if you're sending that traffic down a sieve, it will prove exactly nothing. So again, I send back the teams of saying, is your conversion rate optimized? Is your funnel as tight as it can be? Have you defined your aha moments? Do you understand when that, you know, retention happens, etc.? Because unless this is done, you're going to send people down the sieve and do exactly nothing with it again. Then, as it's kind of tighter, sure, let's start, you know, scaling, etc. And, you know, I'd like to think that at least, you know, well-experienced VCs understand that. I know I have that conversation with them regularly. But, you know, your retention is really the bedrock of your business. I completely agree with you. And you need to constantly, like, balance out retention and acquisition in your growth journey, because you can't do one without the other.
Yeah, for sure. And obviously, it has an impact on your economics and lifetime value and obviously payback period on your acquisition costs. Shifting tack for a second, in one of your Medium articles, you discuss the concept of fitting a giraffe into a brand, which I kind of love that. I love that metaphor and that visualization. But can you explain to our listeners like what it is that you meant and how it applies to both brand building and marketing strategy?
So this applies to YouLife actually specifically. It's an article I wrote after working with YouLife on their messaging and branding and kind of establishing the foundation for their growth. When I started working with Sam and Sammy at YouLife, they already had a brand mascot, if you like, that was a giraffe. For a life insurance company that sells to HR managers, right, that are looking for corporate
life insurance. It might have worked in Kenya, but it...
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was quite, you know, I was a bit taken aback saying like, okay, that's going to be a complicated one. But the foundation of it is that when you look, if you go deep with the founders on the essence of their business, the narrative, the why they're doing this, why are they transforming life insurance, such an ancient and, you know, quite gloomy product. And they tell you, you know, we're here to bring life back into life insurance. You know, we have this wellness app that helps people stay healthy, you know, on the back of having life insurance as well, etc. And the giraffe is the animal that has the biggest heart on earth, right?
It's going to pump blood up the neck.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then you're like, right, it kind of stacks up. So then we develop their narrative, we deliver their messaging, you know, this animal makes sense. You can like bring him to life, you know, or it to life into the whole thing. I think it was a male animal. We were calling him Yogi, but so that's really the essence. And really what this story says is it's really your brand identity needs to emerge from your narrative and your impact in the world and your messaging, not the other way around. And I see too many founders and businesses rushing into like, I need a brand identity. I'm like, you don't even know who you are yet. Like, how would that
make
sense?
And at the earliest stages, the brand is so heavily entwined with the founder and the founding team that it isn't mature enough to actually set itself out as a standalone brand of
its own,
right?
That's right. And, you know, obviously it served them very well and they're still using it. But that's really my story about how do you fit a giraffe into a, you know, a tech business kind of, you know, product. It's really inviting people to kind of dig deep into why they're doing this, what it's represented. And actually, the even great brand designers will only do a great job if they can be inspired by that mission and that storytelling that the business is building.
I'm so glad you said that. I mean, like, I spend most of my time as a CFO, as a founder, as an operator, as someone who sits on this podcast for far too much time during my week. You know, I'm sure my wife would be happier if I was out driving new business. But anyway, but the kind of core principle that I talk about is narrative over numbers, right? So everything comes back to what is the story that you can tell? What is the narrative? What is it that will grab people? I think this is partly because I'm a linguist. I was someone who loved the English language growing up, loved sort of writing fiction, et cetera, et cetera. And the power of stories, and I love Terry Pratchett talks about, you know, human beings as being the storytelling ape, right? The power of those narratives, that's what grips people. That's what gets people engaged. It's what brings them to your brand. It's what brings them to your service. No one wants to buy, you know, a thing. You know, it's why Budweiser's got in a bunch of trouble recently for whatever their recent marketing campaign was. It's why Ben and Jerry's constantly are kind of like in the news as being overly woke or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they've realized that their narrative is just that, right? Mm-hmm. That they want to present themselves as a company that cares about whatever that topic is, because it might be core to their identity, but it's clearly core to their customer's identity. Or maybe that works the other way around. Their customers are drawn to them precisely because they've set themselves out to have that core identity. So how would you recommend to companies that are struggling to understand their own identity and create that? How can they start? Is it a question of sitting down with someone like you and just having a conversation to and fro? You know, can you chuck something in this chat GPT and say, you know, ask me 20 questions and then develop my mission? Like, what's the best way of going about it?
I mean, there's two ways here. You know, some founders start, you know, if we take YouLife again as example, they start with a clear vision, mission, understanding of how they're trying to transform that that industry, right? So that will guide a lot of your narrative. Obviously, it needs to resonate with your audience, and it needs to meet what your audience is trying to get out of it as well. Mm. Some others obviously will be like, you know, there's a problem to solve. It's a worthwhile problem to solve. You know, I don't have any bigger kind of, you know, raison d'être than trying to solve that problem. Then really starting with your audience, with what resonates with them, what are the struggles in their lives and things like that. You know, I mean, take something as dull as an accounting software, which both you and me have to use and hate on a daily basis, despite great ones being out there. What do we want to do? We don't care for the accounting software. We just want to run a business and ideally do as little accounting as possible, right? So, you know, those kind of businesses are very functional businesses. There's no, apart from possible hate, sorry, accountants, like there's not that much emotion in accounting from like the day-to-day user.
But interestingly, like a lot of them, like QuickBooks, I think is a great example. Mm. On LinkedIn, you'll see their ads and they're the most frustrating ads on the planet because they almost try and drive emotion. And the emotion is actually like anger.
Yeah.
You know,
right. Possibly. But surely what you and I want to feel actually is just like, I'm doing right by my business, yeah. and things are automated enough that I can focus on my business, yeah. not my accounting.
Make it easy.
Right. And so that's really starting with your customer, right?
Right.
It's really understanding what's frustrating them, what are they actually trying to do with their lives, and how is this just a micro component of this, you know, greater why?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So that's kind of the two ways. Usually the founders that start with a mission and a vision in mind, often are also the worst at articulating it, and they kind of need to be like interviewed and someone played back to them, because sometimes they don't even realize the power of that ambitions of their mission, and they're like, you know, I kind of talk about this, but you know, it's maybe a bit, you know, quirky, or it's maybe a bit, you know, woke, or you know, uninteresting to people or something, I don't know. Like, and you really need to listen to them, download that, and play it back to them.
Yeah, and often so many of these things are emergent, right? Rather than fixed.
They don't always have exactly the right language and things like that, but the essence is there.
Yeah, I mean, even if I think about kind of how I've built the sort of, you know, the almost the elevator pitch for Emerge One over time,
yeah.
It took me like several years to actually get it down to like, oh, actually, this is what we do. Mm-hmm. And articulate in a way that is simple, easy to understand, yeah. And actually just nails, you know.
And you know, amazing brand strategists and copywriters are really there for that. And you know, I can speak even of my own. I've just like refreshed my own website. I mean, I need to work with great copywriters because we kind of exchange on that, and they're actually finding the exact right language to express it, because that's really their
that's
power.
That's what they do.
That's
yeah.
what they do.
Yeah.
But they need the right brief and they need the right content for it. And I think that's where sometimes I see founders struggling. They're like, well, I hired that copywriter, they never delivered. I'm like, but they don't have
you
the foundations
to
work
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
They're here to find the right language to a defined message, really. And so that's really where they struggle.
Actually, just taking that as a bit of a cue, because I think this is the other problem, right? And I've seen this with a lot of startups that I've worked with in the past, where you know, founders or the wider team, you know, maybe sales are stagnant, maybe sort of you know, growth has flatlined a little bit, and their assumption is that a marketing person can come in and just move that needle immediately. And I've literally seen this in one of the ventures I used to work with, where you know, the founder had brought in a CMO. CMO had been there for, I don't know, 2 weeks. Was a CMO, so was thinking about brand strategy, bigger picture, longer term, et cetera. Whereas founder was sort of like, well, why have we not seen more signups since you started? And it's like, well, that's a very different discipline, right? And B, to be able to move the dial on those startups, you still got to start with the bigger picture. Because if you don't, you could throw a bunch of money at just trying to acquire, you know, whoever as a customer. But ultimately, if you don't know who that customer is or should be, or who that persona is, or where you should be scouting for them, where do they live, where are they, you know, where do they live online, as it were, you know, you're never gonna get to where you want to go, right?
I mean, there's a few things when we talk about growth specifically, and it can, you know, be part of a CMO and their marketing team responsibilities, obviously, but when we talk about holistic growth, it's a cross-functional sport, right? So do we understand our audience? Do we have the right product? Do we have even the right operations, customer service? Like, it's a 360 game. And really, I would be very wary of founders trying to completely outsource it. The other one, you're totally right. There's a foundational element required. And so, you know, again, startups that chat to me saying, you know, growth is stagnant, needs to change, blah, blah, you know, can you unlock it? I'm like, yes, but let's look at what you have today and how far down the foundations we need to go, right? Because it's never really a PPC optimization problem, right? It's really a much more foundational who you're going after, your product, et cetera, your messaging. Building on what you said earlier about like the brand and the message and all of that, that is part of your mix. Now it can be dialed up or down depending on the stage, but if they're really lost their ways, and maybe retention even is not there and acquisition is stagnant or declining, et cetera, as in like they're not acquiring as fast as they used to, you know, you kind of need to go back to the drawing board of, you know, has the industry changed? Has the customer need changed? Has the alternative changed? And kind of going back to some of those foundations to then reset it. And it's rare that you can do that overnight.
Yeah. I think, yeah, there's, again, like, this is one of those podcasts where I'm sort of sat here going, okay, we could talk about this for another 3 hours very, very easily. Because, I think there are so many examples of people putting the cart before the horse, right? Like, sort of just assuming that, okay, if I hire the CMO, if I hire the digital, you know, the digital marketing expert, or, you know, if I throw some more money at this, you know, it'll just happen. Whereas actually, you've got to take it from a first principles approach, right? And the other thing, and I think, you know, just moving on to kind of the next question I had, which is sort of related to some extent, is you've written about the importance of building trust in a startup. And I think about this all the time, because ultimately, as a startup, especially those that are selling into established businesses, those businesses need to understand that you're going to be here today to support them and you're going to be here tomorrow, right? And that trust element is massive. And I've seen it with businesses I've worked with where, you know, they're working with governmental or quasi-governmental institutions. How do you prove that you have the balance sheet, the support of your team and your investors, et cetera, to keep things going? So what are some practical strategies for startups to build and maintain trust with their customers in today's environment? And again, especially when there's just so much noise out there, right?
Yeah, and building what you said, I think it's true when you're trying to work with enterprise, but also true for a consumer business, to be honest. I mean, you know, I think it's quite scary the amount of scams that we're all surrounded by, and, you know, and I don't think that only like older people get scammed these days, right? We can all pretend to be as savvy as we want with digital stuff. You know, it still happens to anyone, and so trust building becomes essential. Most importantly, because if they've never heard of you or your product, right, like you're starting from minus one, not even zero to some extent. I mean, some of the topics I covered, because we, you know, across startups and in my own career, I tried to use them extensively. You know, I'll start with the one that people are most familiar with, which is the social proof, right? Like everyone's like, oh, okay, I need some social proof. I need some customer reviews, etc. Sure. However, we have to remember that this becomes very quickly vanilla. And really what people want to know is, are people like me liking it? are people who are trying to do what I try to do here really liking it? So I like the example, for example, from Booking.com, which is obviously such a mass product now. But you can triage their reviews by couples travelers, solo travelers, business travelers, family travelers, because, you know, I can guarantee them from my own experience, when I travel on my own or with my husband, my requirements are very different than when I'm traveling with my kid, right?
100%.
And I'll be staying into a million different. So again, how do I know that this fits the purpose of what I'm trying to do? So they clearly identified those as being major elements. So again, yes, everyone talks about social proof, absolutely important, but we really need to take it one step further and again use it very smartly in alleviating maybe some of the concerns someone might have before using a product like that and showing that others have, you know, proven the case that it's not that, you know, it's fine. For again, any of those businesses, you know, the experience aspect of trust is essential. How do you give them access to your product for free for a period of time, an easy get out, you know, card or whatever that is, just to be like, let me try it out and see if I really like it. And if you've really built a problem, you know, sorry, a product that solves a real problem and is really intuitive as promised and all of that, they will stay on, or at least you have permission to engage with them, get some feedback, and, you know, fix it as well, right? So that's the experience aspect for those businesses, again, really important. You know, for D2C businesses, it's a, you know, a free trial, or like, you know, an actual, you know, access to a sample or something like that. Really important. Trust by affiliation. Mm-hmm. So that can be anything from investors, regulators, experts, right? So, I mean, obviously, if you're an online doctor proposition, where's the doctor, right? Like, kind of thing. It might be a regulator, the FSA for fintechs. You know, we obviously had an NHS affiliation, a pharmacy to you, and others like that. Again, how do you develop this? You know, other how can a prospect delegate that trust, you know, that affiliation as a proxy to their own trust. Mm-hmm. Again, really important. It can be an award. It can be a, you know, even the credibility of your founders is, you know, credibility by affiliation. So building some of that. One of my favorite ones, and I think that is not used enough, is actually trust by design. Hmm. And the experts of that are really Airbnb, right? The whole platform is built on trust. You know, am I trusting that person to stay in my house and not wreck it? Am I trusting this host to actually provide the service that they're promising? And so what Airbnb did throughout is actually, if you think of the messaging function with your host, by default is built in such a way that there's prompts. How about you tell them about why you're coming and who you're coming, etc.
So it builds that rapport.
You kind of, in the design, they're almost like telling that, you know, guest in this case, how to build that trust. And, you know, for the vast majority of us, we're very happy to say where we're coming and where we're staying, etc. And those of us who are not, well, then great, don't stay here, right? Kind of thing. So there's that aspect. So really trust by design, right? Like, trust is the most important commodity in relationships, and is the same for brands. And so you really have to build trust at every single touch point. Mm. And so it shouldn't be that any different in that experience, in that design, right? So you're now moving almost from like that prospect, you know, trust building into the actual experience within your product, which I find really important. And then, you know, you touched on this greater good, right? Like, why are you here? What's the greater good you're trying to accomplish? Obviously, you know, please no greenwashing and all of that, but like, what, you know, and that greater good can really be just built in the way you're doing something. So at Pharmacy to You, you know, we were saving the NHS money by dispensing at scale, at volume, etc. So that was really our greater good story. And we could, you know, I spent a lot of time substantiating those numbers, getting approval from the NHS, working literally with the ex-finance director of the NHS to like get those numbers right to prove our point. Because really the reason we're doing that is, you know, distribution at scale costs less, right? And we could prove that it was still very much, you know, the error rates was smaller, and, you know, and people were more adherent to their prescription medication because they weren't running out, because, you know, people were reminding them to fulfill and all of that. So those are like the main aspects that I usually call out to kind of summarize.
I mean, I guess like, you know, the Pharmacy to You example, the trust is, don't take your meds, you're going to die or have a heart attack or whatever. Like, that builds a huge amount of trust. Like,
yes.
But it's very easy to break that trust if, as an example, you don't deliver on time or do so. So you've got to then, you've not only got to build the trust, but you've then got to live up to that trust.
That's right. There's like the, you know, can I give you enough prompts to see that I'm trustworthy with your meds? And obviously so much more important than like, oh, okay, my socks didn't make it, big deal.
Yeah.
So there's like this like prospecting, like justifying them to giving you a try, and we couldn't really do free trials. Like, you had to try it. Like, there was no other version for that. But obviously, it was super easy to get out and all of that. And then, throughout every single touch point, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this all the time. And just as you were saying it, I think I've personally done this subconsciously with this business and thought about it when I was building my tech business. Because I operate in finance, trust is like a massively important factor. And the way I've done that is exactly as you say, by proxy, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the business that we generate comes via VCs. The reason it comes via VCs is because I've built trust and relationships individually with them, who and they're happy to potentially I hope they're happy to potentially then kind of refer me down the track to their portfolio companies. And by extension, because the CFOs that work with me, that trust is extended down that train.
Yeah.
But it could be very easy to break that trust. And that happens the first time I bring someone into the team that shouldn't be on the team, for expediency. Mm-hmm. Or we just don't simply live up to kind of the fulfillment of the promise that we made.
Yeah.
And of course, at its most dire, if we do something that is, against our fiduciary sort mm-hmm. of duties. So I think this trust element is massively important. I think from industry to industry, it does change, exactly to your point. If you are selling a pair of socks, it's a very different proposition to selling medication or someone's financial health or future or whatever.
Yeah.
But equally, socks are a commodity product that people will buy again and again and again. Mm-hmm. If you play with that trust, you'll lose that customer. And again, as we've said, if it's a commodity product, low margin, low unit economics, you don't want to be constantly acquiring new customers. You want that person to come back and buy more socks or more products, right?
Yeah, I think the distinction I'm making is that, convincing someone to give a try to buying socks with you is just an easier sell than when it comes to your finances, your health, and all of that. So the amount of pre-trust building that you have to do with those businesses is much bigger.
Yeah.
But then for the rest, it's the same for everyone else, right? Like, once they're in, you need to, live up to that trust and that promise that you've made. And I always joke with my teams, because I'm like, the marketers tend to be turned into the biggest liars on the world.
Excellent.
Because, right? But that's what it is, right? Because if the promise doesn't live up to it, you promised a whole bunch of rubbish. And so I always again say is like, when you're part of that like growth cross-functional team, that's also why it needs to be cross-functional. And I know at Pharmacy to You as well, we're growing so fast, I needed to balance out my growth with how much we could fulfill.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's a constant basis again of saying, well, it's great if the flywheel is doing really well for you.
Mm.
But actually, you need to really temper it. And you can't say, well, I got you the clients, you couldn't fulfill them, your problem. Like, again, growth is a cross-functional sport. You can't really do it separately and independently.
Yeah.
And that's the other big issue I see in most businesses. They kind of, despite being relatively small, are already siloed, and kind of bringing them back into that growth mentality, cross-functional growth, becomes super important so that you don't break that trust. And actually are delivering to the promises that you're making publicly, right? Through your marketing team.
100%. So look, just as we wrap up, you've been involved with Ventures Together as an angel investor for a couple of years now. Can you share more about Ventures Together and why you joined them in particular?
Yeah.
And how you would define your own kind of investment philosophy?
Yeah. So Ventures Together are an angel community of about 150 startup operators and founders, current or former. And really, we're a group of people that came together to source, angel deals together, share them, DD them together, debate them together, and then, make sure that we can provide the most value to those investments, really, because there's such a wide variety of talents around the table.
Mm-hmm.
What was particularly of interest to me is that, I was very new to angel investing. It was still perceived as a kind of, ex-CEOs.
Old
boys club, retired CEOs that were like non-execs and angel investors, doing that quite secretively somewhere, And so for me, it was really a place to learn about angel investing. Obviously, I had, I could use my marketing read of businesses, but, I couldn't DD the upside of the business or ask something, I'm no CFO either, right? As much as we're very much kind of balance sheet and invested at Pharmacy to You. So that's that was really interesting to me. For me, it was, when I exited Pharmacy to You, I wanted to give back into the ecosystem that, supported me for a very long time. And I liked early stage businesses, so I wanted to be more in the ecosystem for that. So that's really what kind of it allowed me to do, really encourage people to seek. And there's more of those groups now in the UK and beyond, where it's a great way to learn. So, I bring deals that I see that I want to champion for the group, and we can and all invest together, where I very heavily also benefit from those investments. And before kind of finding ventures together, I did a couple of deals myself and really realized like just the time intensity of all and the paperwork. And I also did a kind of friends family LP investment with Antler, and that was again another ball game. So I just, you know, wanted more of that as a group. Did I develop an investment philosophy? I always say I invest with empathy to the problem or the audience. I think it's very reflective of basically being a marketer. Do I understand the problem? Do I understand the audience? Do I understand what we're dealing with? And so that obviously led me down the path of health tech and femtech specifically, but also the future of work, because I worked with large organizations in the past, so I understand the kind of, you know, managerial dynamics, the like all of that and how we can improve on those. I then kind of, you know, discovered some wild cards here and there, and usually second time founders where, you know, again, their pedigree and credibility of, and for some of them, building unicorns in the past did not guarantee a second success, but definitely increases the chances. So, you know, you kind of engage with those and you want to see their path and how they build as well. So there's a mix of those happening there. And then since then, I was very fortunate to be invited into the Atomico Angel program. So I saw scout for them. And then I discovered AI as part of all of that as well. So I've just, we're just working on an AI ticket, which is actually based on the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So there's also like all of that coming to like really tangible application of AI on business models that I understand that truly power the value of that marketplace beyond the connection point.
And is it something that you think you'll do more of and more professionally, or is it, do you treat it more as like a side, kind of not a side project as such, but something that you keep your hand in and you're interested in, but it's never going to be your kind of full-time?
Well, it's a nice mix, I guess, in my portfolio work. I think on one hand, I can be very operational when I'm a fractional CMO with businesses through Marketing Cube. Then obviously being a board advisor, you're less hands-on, but you really bring both your growth expertise and your investing expertise to the table in the conversations, because both come hand in hand almost in that. And so that's what I really like, not only from like just, you know, hopefully some returns one day too, obviously, as part of my overall investment strategy. But it really gives you a pulse on like what's flying off the shelf when it comes to investment, what concerns people tend to raise on deals of a specific type, and being able to bring it back. I am starting to do more and more kind of more of an operating partner type of role with VCs, and hope to do more around that. And would that at some point spill over in me doing more investing more professionally, possibly? Is it like super like that's my mission in life right now? No, I do like the diversity, and I think that that multifaceted angles becomes important. I read somewhere, I wish I remembered where recently, but someone was referencing the fact that you kind of invited to be good at one thing, right? Like this one thing. And I'm like, and I think I was pretty generalist even in marketing and this and that. And really just the variety is something I was looking for, and they really were highlighting the fact that actually you should be good at two or three things, and that combo of two or three things make you quite unique. So I often worked off like, you know, my cultural kind of awareness, my personal kind of cultural background, my languages, that always added like a special kind of little amount of sparkle on what I was doing. And that's how I ended up, you know, starting Google Russia because I spoke Russian. That's how I ended up being assigned to EMEA Emerging Markets because I was, you know, part of my heritage is in MENA and I understood the dynamics. So all of that. So I, you know, kind of, you know, maybe parting thoughts possibly, but like, don't, you know, yeah, sure. Have like what, you know, obviously
be passionate about something.
Yeah, but be passionate about something or be good at one thing, but actually definitely add those additional elements that are quite complementary in the mix.
I mean, like I literally wrote an article entitled why I am a specialist at being a generalist. I mean, like I think in today's world, generalism is actually key. You know, some people call it polymathy. You know, I think that's a bit of a highfalutin term for just being, you know, able to connect the dots amongst several disciplines, but you need to understand, you know, enough about those disciplines to be able to do that. And I fully agree. I think, you know, especially when you're someone that's in a fractional kind of role, you need to be cross-disciplinary because you need to understand enough about all aspects of the business, the market, et cetera, to make a difference. And in terms of the investment kind of philosophy, or just that thinking around investment, I was talking to Andy Ayam from the Angel Investing School. I was on the pod last week, and you know, one of the things he said is, you know, when you think about people who do MBAs, you know, they spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 plus to go to a business
more,
school,
think,
and way more. Like I, you know, depends what school. I think I think I've been offered a scholarship to an online one, and it's still going to cost me more than I would pay. But the point is, like, you a lot of people would pay that money to go off and do an MBA. And he's like, well, think about investing as paying to do your MBA, but in a different way. So every time you're making that investment, you're learning something new, you are gathering new information, you are understanding about a new market or a new product or a new technology.
That's right.
But Maya, look, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here on the podcast with me today. For our audience, for our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can they find you?
Yep, LinkedIn, very very active on LinkedIn. Please feel free to follow, kind of posting about startups and growth in general. And then for those interested in fractional roles, I'm also doing a Maven course on how to get started. You know, the I think a report from Edelman says 50% of the American workforce will be freelance as an independent by 2027 or something.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's quite, you know, that's big. And it's rare that you have one single income stream when you're freelance. So, you know, I'm
well aware.
Yeah, well aware, right. So, yeah, so that's, again, another topic that I tend to get asked a fair bit about.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.